Accession number 28351, Reel 3.
Lord Peter Baker, Reel 3.
Yes, the instructor at the Kingston College asked me whether I would like to go for the A or the Q side of the army. And I, being 19 or 20, said the A side, meaning the military action side, because that was a natural thing for me to do, especially since I felt I had a father in a prisoner of war camp in Hong Kong. And he'd been in the infantry when he was in the First World War. So I said the A side, and the instructor clearly was disappointed at that. He said the Q side is very interesting, you know. But I said, no thanks. But I would have been very sensible to do it. He got me right, actually. I got myself wrong.
You were only 20, I think, at the time, were you not?
Just 19 or 20, just about my birthday.
So what was the next stage of training for you?
Next stage of training, I was sent in the middle of the winter of 1942-43 to Shiloh, Manitoba, which is a bit west of Winnipeg, on the prairies. And this was an anti-tank gun school where people were sent from different regiments, because there was a new anti-tank gun which had just been introduced into the Canadian Army. It wasn't very big by modern standards, but it was a big improvement on what came before. But this course was in January, and the prairies of Canada in January tend to be rather cold. And this year was particularly cold. It didn't get above 40 degrees below zero for the whole month that we were there. That is, of course, Fahrenheit. And we couldn't fire the guns at all, because if we'd fired a gun with live ammunition, the recoil mechanism of the barrel would not have worked. So instead of the barrel running back on its chassis, the whole gun would have leapt back, thus doing great harm to the crew who would have been crushed. So we couldn't fire a single shot. But we did all the drill. We lived in a Nissen hut type of buildings with a blazing stove in the middle of the room, keeping us very warm. Indoors we were very warm. As soon as we got outside, even though we were wearing wooden gloves covered with leather mittens, and all sorts of warm clothes. We marched over to the drill hall, and by the time we got to the drill hall, the end of our fingers were just beginning to get cold. So that was a bit of a, wasn't altogether a washout, but because we learned the drill all right, but it wasn't as much, it wasn't so interesting as it would otherwise have been. After I went back to the regiment, I was asked by the commanding officer to put on a demonstration of the firing of the anti-tank gun for the regiment, which my little group of anti-tank gunners whom I'd trained and I were going to do, and we did it. We had a target. We were beside the sea anyway, and we had a target out in the bay consisting of a canvas screen, which we were to aim at. And so we did. We only had one shot to fire, which was rather disappointing, or maybe two. And we fired. I'm glad to say we hit the target either, if we shot once, we hit the target with that shot, and if there were two, we hit them with both. Hit the target with both. So it was a success. But it was a bit of an anticlimax for the regiment, because those of the regiment who were attending, because it was all over in about half a minute. However, we demonstrated we could do the drill. So then I went back to the regiment, which by this time was in Nova Scotia, at a place called Lebert, which was inland in Nova Scotia, a very unattractive place, dark forests round about, lots of mud. And we were part of the 7th Canadian Division. It's amazing that there were at that time 7 Canadian divisions. There were 3 overseas, I think, only, divisions 1, 2, and 3. The 4th Canadian Armoured Division, I don't think at that time, I may be wrong, had been properly assembled yet. I think it was still in Canada. That division, in due course, was broken up while we were in Nova Scotia in a different location, which was a great disappointment to us. And the reason the 7th Division was broken up was because the Canadian casualties, I understand that the Canadian casualties were greater than expected. In Italy, this must have been. And, of course, the Canadians lost a whole brigade in Hong Kong. A Canadian brigade was sent to Hong Kong 3 weeks before the Japanese attack. At Churchill's request, he requested the Canadian government to send some troops to Hong Kong to demonstrate to the Japanese that we intended to defend Hong Kong. And of course, they were all put in the bag, apart from their commanding officer who was killed. The brigadier was killed. So that was a great blow to Canada. I think that was the first Canadian military action of World War II. I may be wrong, but it was before Dieppe, obviously, which was in August 42, and before the Canadians were in Italy. So by the end of 43, as I say, we were disbanded. The 2nd 10th Dragoons were disbanded. I was the adjutant by that time. And we had a telegram from National Defense Headquarters saying, please report your complement and your actual numbers of men. And we were short of only 3 men. We had whatever the appropriate number was, 650 or something like that. And we were short of 3, so we said, well, you know, nobody can be more up to strength than we are, and expected that we would be chosen to go overseas, which was everybody's ambition. But we got a telegram a few days later saying, you are disbanded. And so that was the breaking up of the regiment.
Was that a great blow?
Great blow, great blow. Especially for me as the adjutant, since I received the telegram. Anyway, in Nova Scotia, going back a little bit, we were at De Burt for a while. It's a big camp with several regiments in it. And then we moved on to Cape Breton Island, which at that time was the most easterly part of Canada. Newfoundland was not then part of Canada. It was very close to Newfoundland. And the purpose of our being there was to defend the western end of the Atlantic Telegraph Cable, which came ashore on that island, I understand. And it was thought that the Germans might make a raid on the cable to destroy it, so as to disrupt communication between Churchill and Roosevelt. But they never tried it, I'm glad to say. It was a very attractive island in the summer, fishing, lakes, trees, forests. In the winter, it was rather unattractive because it was very foggy and damp. This is a result of a combination of the Labrador current coming down from along the coast of Labrador and the Atlantic meeting it. And so we trained there. I remember one occasion when we spent several days out of doors sleeping in bedrolls. I don't think we even had tents. And fortunately, that was in the summer. And I remember waking up the first morning and seeing a clear sky, going to sleep, seeing the stars above, and waking up with a blue sky, thinking how absolutely wonderful. I felt absolutely fit. But otherwise not a terribly attractive area. It was, there was a steel mill at Sydney, which was the principal town on Cape Breton Island, and we were one of our companies was stationed there, and I was stationed there also, being the adjutant. And that was producing steel, which I suppose was relevant for the war effort. And every so often, it was working night and day, every so often at night the sky would be lit up as they poured the molten metal, and the sky suddenly turned bright. I remember walking along the harbour edge in Sydney one day, must have been in the winter, when a naval officer came up to me and said, "I hope you don't mind my telling you, but your ear is frozen." I was unaware of the fact, but it wasn't paining me or anything like that, so I put my hand up as if to touch my ear, and he said, "Don't do it, because if you squeeze it, it may break off. The bit you squeeze may break off." And I did actually very gently touch it, and it was like a potato crisp.
How did he know? Did it look?
It was white. He was familiar with the phenomenon. And what one did was to get a bit of snow and rub it very, very gently on the ear, and that suddenly enough would get it back into the right sort of condition. So that's what I did.
Was there any enemy activity, any attempt, you know, submarines or
I think there were submarines off the coast, but we weren't aware of any enemy activity there in Cape Breton Island. They simply didn't attempt anything.
But obviously a very vulnerable spot, as you were saying, because Churchill and Roosevelt were,
yes,
that was their main communication.
If the Germans had thought of it and attempted an assault by surprise in the dark or something like that from a submarine, I think they would have had a good chance of success, which is not a reflection on my regiment, but the reality of the situation. But I suppose our presence there, if it was known to the Germans, might have been a bit of a deterrent.
You were at this stage adjutant, so you would have been a captain, wouldn't
yes.
you? Yes. Yes. Now, I wondered, here you are, an Englishman, you know, in your voice, and I would think appearance, and as you say, your behaviour, regarding, you know, formality. How were you getting on with the Canucks, the Canadians?
Well, there were some of the other officers who regarded me as rather a proper Englishman, and I got teased a bit about that, not very much. Of course, my speech was strange to them, and I had to train my own platoon. Before I became adjutant, I had my own platoon, and I had to instruct them in all sorts of military activities, anti-gas measures, and how to strip a machine gun, all that sort of thing, speaking in an English accent. And after I'd been doing this for a little while, I realized that much of the time I was faced with a row of blank faces. It's 30 blank faces. So I said to myself, it's not because they're stupid, it's because they can't understand me. And so I said, I'm going to speak Canadian from now on. And having been in Canada by then for 2.5 or 3 years, entirely in a Canadian environment, I didn't find it difficult at all. Within a month, I was speaking Canadian, having deliberately taken the decision to do so. And after that, there was only one person, one Canadian, who said to me, "You didn't originate in Canada, did you?" So I had a good ear.
Can you still speak Canadian?
I couldn't do it now. But when I came back across the Atlantic in the summer of 44, I telephoned my aunt, the one who lived in London, and she was deeply shocked at this. I said, "This is Peter, your nephew Peter." She said, "You can't possibly be," as if I was an imposter. And I continued to speak Canadian, of course, until after the war, when I was sent by the Canadian Army to Oxford. And I was still speaking Canadian then. I'd only been in the Canadian Army the week before. But gradually, over the next little while, when I decided I was going to stay in England, I reverted to what I speak now.
It isn't interesting that you do this consciously, isn't it?
Yes.
One can do this.
Well, if you've got an ear, some people can, some people can't. But I was used to learning languages a bit. So I didn't find it difficult. I found it came very easily.
Were you wanting to go overseas? You know, and perhaps before we go into that, could I ask you about the Dieppe raid? This would have been in 1942, of course, and the effects that had, so far as you knew, in Canada.
Oh,
a very bad time.
Oh, awful. I mean, it was mainly a Canadian raid. And Mountbatten, I believe, recommended this raid. For what reason, I'm not quite clear. And Canadian casualties were very heavy. It happened the week before I actually joined my regiment, in August 42. And so it was a deep, deep shock. I mean, much more shocking than the capture of the Canadian brigade in Hong Kong, where the casualties were not so high. But the Canadian casualties at Dieppe were a very high percentage of all those involved.
So could we now go to your overseas posting, how this came about?
Yes. Well, the regiment having been broken up, we all got split up, and the troops were, I suppose, distributed amongst other regiments. The officers were also split up and sent in different directions. I was sent to an officer's holding depot in Aldershot, Nova Scotia, a very beautiful part of Canada. Apple growing again, and one did a bit of training, retraining. I think actually before I got to this holding depot, I was sent to a retraining course at a place called Brockville in Ontario, where other officers were doing the same thing, refresher courses in what we ought to know. And then I was sent to Aldershot, Nova Scotia. And there one was very busy. I did a lot of running to keep fit, and I was out running round the running course one day, and somebody came out to find me and said, you're wanted at the headquarters because you're about to go overseas. And so I packed that in and got ready for going overseas. And we went then to Halifax, Nova Scotia, to catch a ship. And most of the Canadian troops, virtually all of them, coming over to the UK, travelled in a large liner, usually the Andes, which was a cruise liner, I think, in peacetime, and was absolutely jam-packed with troops in wartime. Every square inch of the ship was taken up with troops, so much so that you didn't have your own bunk. You had use of a hammock, which you shared with two other people 8 hours at a time for each. So you had your hammock for 8 hours, and then you had to get out of your hammock and release it to somebody else. So that was pretty uncomfortable. You had only two meals a day, and you had nowhere particularly to sit on deck, because there weren't enough chairs to sit in. Certainly no deluxe activities. And the compensation was that the trip was very quick, because I think it came over probably escorted by a frigate or a destroyer or something like that, but not in a convoy. Of course, a convoy moved very slowly. So we expected to go on the Andes. And we were told, a group of about 40 of us were told one day to assemble, and we were marched down to the dock. And we got to the dock, and we couldn't see a ship. And so we said to the movement officer, Major so-and-so, "Sir, where's our ship? I can't see any ship." He said, "Don't you worry, you just march along to the end of the dock and you'll be all right." So we marched along to the end of the dock, and there, when we looked over the edge of the dock, down below, the tide being out, was a tiny little ship, which was a banana boat from the Elder and Fife line, which in peacetime had been used for carrying bananas to Liverpool from the Caribbean, had refrigerated space, but in wartime was carrying frozen meat in the refrigerated space and was carrying troops. It had capacity for passengers who used to travel to the Caribbean and back in peacetime, quite an agreeable trip. And so we were marched on board, and we were told, "This is your bunk," that is your colleague's bunk, two bunks per room, one bunk per officer, which he had use of 24 hours a day if he wanted to lie down, in contrast to the hammock for 8 hours. We thought, well, this is not so bad after all. But we didn't seem to be very full, the ship didn't seem to be quite full, so we thought there must be more people coming on. And then we heard tramp, tramp, tramp on the upper deck, and on marched 40 members of the Canadian Women's Army Corps. So we said to ourselves, how on earth did this happen? It can't have been intended by the organizers at Defense Headquarters, but perhaps it was. Perhaps somebody had a sense of humor. Anyway, we had a very good time. For 16 days, it took 16 days to cross the Atlantic, mostly very calm, sunshine, convoy of, I don't know, probably 20 ships, with quite a number of warships to protect us. One or two ships were torpedoed, but we were lucky. We got away without any problems and landed at Gourock, Scotland, 16 days after departure. And I can remember the Canadian soldiers, officers, I suppose they were, leaning over the rail, looking at things on the shore, and remarking on the tiny little things on railway lines. And they said, "What are those?" And I said, "Well, those are freight wagons." They said, "How absolutely ridiculous," because they were about a third of the size of a Canadian freight wagon. The Canadian rolling stock was much bigger and much more comfortable and much more capacious than ours. I'm not quite sure why. I raised the question the other day with somebody who knew about railways and said, "I understood the Canadian gauge was wider than ours," but he said, "No, it's the same." Anyway, so that was the first reaction of the Canadian troops to arriving in Scotland. And we moved from there gradually down the country from Scotland to England, covering, I suppose, about one quarter of the distance to the south coast, because of course D-Day had happened by that time, and we moved from stately home to stately home. I remember spending a few days in the laundry at Thoresby Hall, I think that's in Nottinghamshire, a very stately home, and the laundry was vast, with racks which could be lifted on pulleys for the laundry in the great days. And the owner of Thoresby Hall, his wife, lived upstairs, out of the way of the troops, and used to send down a message from time to time saying, "Would anybody like to come and play bridge?" And I didn't volunteer for that. I tried playing bridge during the 16 days on the water coming over, and I found it much too painful to learn.
Would you have been on the water when you heard about D-Day?
Yes. I knew, first I learned about D-Day. I was woken in my cabin by the steward coming. I mean, really as if it had been a peacetime cruise. The steward came and drew the curtains and brought my cup of tea. He said, "We've landed, sir." And I knew what he meant. So that was right in the middle of our 16-day trip. And that was why when we got to Scotland, we were moved steadily down south. And I suppose that was mid-July, August. I landed in France on the 8th of August, I believe, certainly at the beginning of August, and was assigned to the Argyll and Southern and Highlanders of Canada. I'm sure because it came from the same area that the 2nd 10th Dragoons had come from. Therefore, that made sense, because I knew some of the people who...
That would be the Canadian Argylls.
The Canadian Argylls, who are the sister regiment of the Argylls of Scotland, and follow exactly the same traditions, the same wear, apart from the regimental badge, as the Argylls of Scotland, and keep in very close touch now with the Argylls in Scotland, and are very proud of their Scottish traditions. I spoke about 15 years ago at an annual regimental mess dinner, and of course in wartime I hadn't seen the full regalia because we were wearing battle dress, but there they were on this annual mess dinner, 1989 it was, exactly the 20th of October 1989, which was 45 years to the day of my getting wounded. And the whole thing was entirely in the Scottish tradition. The piper played during dinner, the quaich was drunk at the end, the toasts were in Gaelic, I think, or if I've got it right, Scottish anyway. And they are very proud of continuing that that tradition.
Where did you sail from in the UK, from England?
Portsmouth.
Portsmouth, yes. And you say you arrived on the
8th of August. Yes.
Yes. Do you remember the journey? First of all, in Portsmouth, this would have been very soon after D-Day, wouldn't it?
Well, it was 2 months, yes.
Yes.
After D-Day. It was just very busy with people moving here and there in a very orderly fashion. And we didn't waste much time. We got on to a fairly large vessel to take us across. It wasn't just a landing craft, it was a ship. And we docked at Arromanche, the Mulberry, and went ashore there.
So would you have been on, would that have been Juno or Gold Beach that you landed on? Would you know?
Well, the same as the Canadians landed on D-Day.
Yes, that would have been one or the other, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes. I don't remember which.
No. What was the scene on the other end? I mean, what did you see as you were coming on the beaches? Can you remember?
Yes, a few battered houses. Wasn't total destruction at all. We didn't waste time on the beaches. We were marched along. Of course, quite a lot of troops were on the ship coming over. And I remember trees and a path which we were marched up, going up the hill from the beach. I don't remember the detail about Arromanche, except one saw these amazing blocks of concrete, or whatever it was, forming the semicircle which protected the port from the elements, and ships which had been sunk.
Would this be the Mulberry Harbour?
That was the Mulberry Harbour, yes, that's right. And it all worked extremely efficiently. It looked absolutely complete at the time. I think it had suffered in the storms which occurred soon after D-Day, but perhaps the Mulberry hadn't been built by then.
End of Reel 3, Lord Peter Blaker. Lord Peter Blaker...